You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Howard Fineman is Newsweek's senior Washington correspondent, and he's a columnist for the magazine. He's an NBC News analyst and a regular on Hardball with Chris Matthews and Countdown with Keith Olbermann. And in his spare time, he's written a book in which he claims every ongoing debate in our country is rooted in one or another of a baker's dozen of arguments. The 13 American arguments, enduring debates that define and inspire our country, is published by Random House, and I'm very pleased to welcome Howard Fineman to the show today. Hello.
I'm delighted to be here. Hello.
You must be exhausted. How late were you up last night doing your part on the MSNBC coverage of the primary?
Till after midnight. The only last little bit of suspense was whether it was going to be double digits or not, and we managed to keep that drama going till midnight.
Let's get right to the gist of this book. What are the 13 arguments? I don't know if you want to list them all, but
sure.
Can you?
I think I can list them. I even devised a chart, a bullseye chart of them, which I submitted to my editors and asked if they would put it in the book, and they said, you've got to be crazy. And at that point, I almost literally was crazy. But it is a range, a bullseye, a set of rings. The first argument, the most fundamental argument as I see it in American life, has always been and will always be, who is a person in our eyes and in the eyes of the Constitution?
And is that different in other? Was that different in other parts of the world when we came up with our Constitution?
Absolutely, because we said in the Declaration and in the Constitution men and women, or initially men primarily, were born with certain inalienable rights, and that all men were created equal. And we were based for the first time on the notion of looking at the world from the individual soul out to the society and not the other way around.
So is this something that started in this country but then went elsewhere? After all, the French came up with the rights of man when they had their revolution.
Yes, I think it did start here, and I think it has spread elsewhere. And one of the duties and responsibilities and burdens we have as Americans is to understand that we did start something, and the logical extension of it extends to the planet. But yes, we started it. Now, it was a combination of accident and geography and history. And in the first chapter, before I get to the arguments, I give my journalistic overview of the reasons why we are unique. But I argue that we are unique. I guess I'm in the school of American exceptionalists, and I'm proud to stand accused of that.
You even define the word argument in your introduction.
It's the very first thing I do. It's the very first sentence of the book. Because arguing requires listening, not necessarily following, but it requires the ability to hear in stereo, if you will. And it's a dispute between two people or two groups or two interests over policy and direction and public life. I limit myself to public arguments. I mean, this is about public life in America, and it's an attempt to summarize all of American political history with the metaphor and the fact of argument.
And you say that this lucky mix of accident and intention that you just talked about made America born and bred to argue.
That's the essence of it. That's my, as I say, my metaphor and my historical analysis
and
of who we are as a people. And if we don't, and what I go on to say, if we don't honor that destiny, then we aren't operating the way we should.
How much should we attribute that to the fact that our Constitution was written largely by lawyers?
Well, I think the lawyers were reflecting. That is true, and I do make that point. But I think there's a lot of history before that, before we ever get to Philadelphia, that is largely forgotten, and I'm not a scholar on, but did study enough to realize that a lot of the tensions, a lot of the paradoxes, and a lot of the arguments of our society are based on the history that precedes those lawyers. Those lawyers were, in my view, reflecting the culture that already existed and not creating one themselves.
But you claim that our country was conceived with the idea of societal perfection. Now,
well, with
did
the
they
goal
really
of,
imagine that with, we could do that?
No, with the goal of that. It's kind of like the point in the sidewalk. I mean, you're never actually going to reach it no matter how fast you walk. But it's the fact that we posit the possibility of a perfect union that creates a lot of the arguments that we have. And my last argument, my 13th argument, is about how close, the ongoing argument is how close or far away we are from that more perfect union. And just the other month, Barack Obama used that theme in his speech in Philadelphia.
You also say that the internet is the newest west for freedom-seeking utopians. So we just keep on looking for other ways to seek that utopian situation.
Yes, and whenever we go and found a new utopia somewhere, whether it's in Ambridge, Pennsylvania, or Amana, Iowa, or on the internet, we're generating another argument between what is and what we hope will be.
Now, I want to get back to that bullseye. The bullseye that you were talking about is important because another analogy you have is ripples in a pond.
Mm-hmm.
So you start off with one thing, and then that leads to another, and that leads to another, and that leads to another?
I wouldn't say they're all directly linked and causally, but they have a pattern that I saw at any rate. You start with who is a person. The next ring is who is an American.
And is that different?
Yes, because that has to do with citizenship, not personhood. And that's the chapter in which I deal with immigration issues primarily.
Although some Americans see non-Americans as non-persons.
That's true. And I wrestled with that distinction, but decided to make it anyway. The next two are about what we can know and say and believe. So that's about free speech and the free flow of information and about faith and the role of faith in public life. And then the last one of the five that I consider related to individuals is the question of the relationship between the individual community, what the individual owes the community in terms of behavior and money, materially and socially, if you will, and from the other side, what the community owes individuals. That's a very big, complicated chapter in which I deal with everything from taxes to gun control, but that's the way I summarize it. And those first five are the ones related to individuals.
Those are the broader concepts. And then later you get into the nuts and bolts of how we've actually worked things out.
Yeah.
The power of the president, the judiciary, et cetera, et cetera.
Exactly.
You make the point in the book that political labels are functionally meaningless. What do you mean by that?
Well, what I mean by that is the words liberal and conservative are sort of like halls that you can rent. They're there, and different people move in and out of them. Different parties move in and out of them. Different ideas move in and out of them. What might I was trying to say is that it's the deeper substructure. It's the ideas themselves that are important and that cause the contention, not the labels.
So is that one of the reasons that some of the supporters of Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama say that they'll vote for John McCain if their candidate doesn't win the nomination?
To
somebody who would say, well, I'm a Democrat first, that seems stunning. But because John McCain is not the same as Hillary Clinton, and he's not the same as Barack Obama.
Well, I think one of the reasons why the book is timely is that these days party labels, I think, mean less than they have in the past. I think more and more people, especially young people, don't identify with political parties. They know about the tensions and paradoxes of these arguments, but they don't think in terms of parties, and they don't think in terms of those kinds of labels.
My guest is Howard Fineman. You probably saw him on television last night if you were following the primary in Pennsylvania. He's written a book called 13 American Arguments, Enduring Debates That Define and Inspire Our Country. It's published by Random House. In the introduction, you point out that the Supreme Court's decision in 1973 on abortion was viewed by many abortion opponents as a change in policy without public debate. Do you think that's the reason that it continues to be such a contentious issue?
I think it's one of the reasons. Now, there's been a lot more public debate since then. But I think a lot of people were blindsided by the court taking that role in that particular issue, even though, as I point out in the book, the court has always waded into political issues. That's one of the reasons it exists. But for that group of people who hadn't viewed the court in that way, the Roe versus Wade decision was a tremendous shock, and a lot of our politics since then has been affected by the shock waves that came out from that.
Although public debate doesn't always lead to the kind of conclusion we might be proud of. For example, there was a lot of public debate after Reconstruction, and it still took 75 years or so for us to pass a meaningful Civil Rights Act.
That is very true. And one of the things I want to guard against here and was conscious of is not wanting to seem Pollyannish about this. Arguing is a messy business. It's sometimes demeaning. A lot of our politics can be demeaning, and it can be bloody. Let's face it. We fought a civil war. That was the biggest argument we ever had. 600,000 people died. And it took another century, as you point out, for a second civil rights revolution, really, to begin to bring those rights to bear. And today, we do have the first serious African-American candidate for president and the first woman. So we have made progress, but it's halting, it's fitful, it's sometimes bloody, but it is who we are.
Does the fact that their candidates fit into that first argument, who is a person? I mean, abortion is the first thing that comes to mind when I hear that question. But I also wonder whether that applies to a woman and a black man who might very well have been considered inappropriate in an earlier time.
Yes, I think there's a residuum of that in the minds of some voters. In other words, do we say in our society, we've always said in our society, anybody can grow up to be president. And in a way, that's a measure of personhood. Because we're a democracy, and from our ranks, we pick our leaders. So if you're going to cancel somebody out from the possibility of leadership, in a sense, you are denying their personhood. And I think for some people, that's a factor.
You point out that this debate can apply to corporations as well. Would that apply to other capitalist countries, or is this unique to the United States?
I think it's pretty unique the way we've set it up. In most other countries, corporations are more an extension of the government. They have a more governmental type of function. We give corporations governmental responsibilities in a sense. But only in America, I think, could we come up with the idea that a corporation is a person. And there was a famous court case in which Southern Pacific Railroad, I believe, in which we said we're going to treat corporations as people and give them property rights. Now, this was a way that a conservative, to use a cliche and to use a label, a pro-business court squared the circle of corporate power, and we've been living with the consequences of that ever since.
Getting to that second one, who is an American? At the beginning, everybody was an American, anyone who decided to come here, other than the Native Americans.
Yes.
But that's changed.
That has changed.
And it changed fairly soon, didn't it? In the mid-19th century, the debate started?
I think it started. The place that I pick it out as having started was in Philadelphia at the end of the 18th century, when suddenly the founders and others in Philly looked around and there were German farmers everywhere. And some of Ben Franklin's comments about them are rather hair-raising, that these were people bringing in alien culture and that they didn't have the morals of we stout Americans, and they drank too much beer and this and that. And we alternate between xenophobia and necessity and idealism. No country has had more waves of immigration. No country has probably had more arguments about who should be here and why, from the Germans to the Irish, to the Eastern Europeans, to the Italians, to the Jews, now the Hispanics and Asians to some extent. It's always an argument. And it's always one, in the end, that we've settled on the side of welcoming people eventually.
And often economics has been part of the argument. Are there good reasons for economics to be there, or is that one of the things we use to cover up other kinds of attitudes?
In terms of immigration, you mean?
Yeah.
Well, of course.
They're taking jobs from us.
No, that was less true early on, I think. Because there was just so much room. And we had such a desperate need for labor for most of our history. Most of our history we've scoured the earth for people. I mean, some of the amazing things that were written by William Penn's advertising salesman in Europe to get people to come here are very amusing to look at. But when we became an industrial society, when there were too many people in the cities and not always enough jobs, yes, it's become very contentious, and we basically slammed the door in the 1920s. We slammed the door for 40 years.
My guest is Howard Fineman of Newsweek and NBC, among other places. His book, The 13 American Arguments, Enduring Debates That Define and Inspire Our Country, published by Random House, the role of faith, is that the third or the fourth? The third.
Yeah.
That continues to be an issue in one way or another. We saw John McCain get in trouble when he was critical of certain televangelists, and then more recently Barack Obama and the whole matter of his pastor, Jeremiah Wright, has become a major issue here. And you say Bill Frist was a victim of the matter of faith as well.
Well, Bill Frist, who some people may remember, was only a few years ago the Republican leader in the Senate and was thought of as a future presidential candidate, basically was ground up in the gears of the conflict between faith and science. Over Terry Schiavo, over stem cell research. Basically, he was caught between his scientific background, his medical background as a doctor, and a very good one, trained at the Harvard Medical School and at Mass General and so forth, a buccaneer in the new technology of thoracic, heart and chest, heart and lung transplants and so on. He was caught between that, his faith in science, and his Bible Belt background, or the Bible Belt background of his constituency in Tennessee, where, by the way, the Scopes trial happened and where the Southern Baptist Convention is headquartered in Nashville and so on. And he couldn't reconcile the two, and he was a dramatic example of the tensions of the argument. But my view is one of the great paradoxes that leads to this argument in American society is that we do not have an official religion, and yet we're the most arguably the most prayerful country on the face of the earth. And there is a tremendous thriving marketplace of faiths. And that requires of people who would lead us an understanding of both things at the same time, that there's no official faith, and yet we're a prayerful country, and not everybody can master that, and Frist was unable to.
It's also heard Jeb Bush. How has the relationship between what we can know and say as citizens changed since 9/11? You write about Javed Iqbal and his problems.
Yes, he was the guy who set up a satellite receiver so he could get some Middle Eastern broadcasts and sell them in a local cable system here in New York. And I use that as emblematic of the restrictions on the flow of information. One of my pet theories that I talk about in this chapter is that we are uniquely set up for what I call the velocity of information. In theory, everybody in America should know everything about everything. I mean, take it to the mathematical maximum. We should know everything the government is doing. The government should not limit speech in any possible way. There should be virtually no limits. And in terms of libel law and secrecy for much of our history, there hasn't been. But there are episodes and times, especially in war, and that's what I focus on in this chapter, when the government goes far and sometimes too far in limiting the flow of information. And that's the situation we're in right now, in my view.
But it was interesting that it was a real problem during the McCarthy years. And that was a time when America was booming. We had a Cold War, but we didn't have a real war. Why do you think that happened? Is that in any way related to what we've been seeing since 9/11?
Well, the question of whether the Cold War was a real war or not.
Well, the War on Terror is a real war or not.
Or the War on Terror is a real war or not is a very profound one. And I don't pretend to answer that question in that chapter or in the book. What I should say, and what I think I did say in some of that chapter, is that in the name of national security, we have restricted time and again the free flow of information, often to our detriment. The classic example, early example, for anybody who was watching the John Adams series on HBO, was John Adams' now, what is obvious, lunatic effort to basically shut down all debate.
Alien and Sedition Act.
I mean, if you read that, it's a hair-raising thing. And so it's been tried time and again, and presidents overstepped their bounds. What's missing here has been a Congress and, frankly, a media, and I indict myself in passing in the book, howling and screaming about that. We didn't do enough of that then, and I'm not sure we do enough of it now.
And the man who many people credit with being the hero of the McCarthy thing, Edward R. Murrow, he was punished. He was demoted by CBS after he fought that fight. So you don't always, the heroes don't always come out on top, even though we'd like to remember it in a different way. One of the points you make in this book is that none of these arguments have been won. They continue to go on, and that is important, you think, because if any of them is won, then it will really, it will undermine what we're all about?
To some extent. I think also new facts and new situations come in to fill the void. Because the tension in the structure is still there. For example, on the question of who is a person, the pro-life people view the question of a fetus being a person as central to civil rights in their view. And in terms of unlawful enemy combatants, do we view them as people within the eyes of the Constitution? So I think there will always be new things. I make the further point, or argue, if you will, that it's the very tension of these arguments that keeps us free in the end. It's a kind of equipoise that is complicated to maintain but is indispensable to our freedom.
There's some people argue that because Americans don't see Africans as humans, we have pretty much ignored the tragedies of Congo, Darfur, and elsewhere. Zimbabwe right now.
I think there's little doubt about that. And one of the things that we set loose with our Declaration of Independence and our Constitution, but especially the Declaration, was the idea that everybody on the planet is a person. And everybody on the planet is entitled to be seen as such, which is one reason why the argument over unlawful enemy combatants is so difficult. Because what the proponents of those people getting rights in American courts are saying is, now, wait a minute. We say that all men are created equal and endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights. If we're saying that of ourselves, how can we deny it to the rest of the planet? And I deal with that some in that chapter and in foreign policy as well.
You said that the media bear a certain amount of blame. Jefferson wanted the media to play a major role. But what we do now is we get two opponents in a room, and then we ask them a couple of provocative questions and then sit back and enjoy the show.
Well,
is that arguing?
Well, it's not arguing.
I mean, the debates have been like that to some degree, haven't they?
Yeah,
a lot of people who complain that not much has come out of them because they've really been about something else.
I wouldn't argue that the question of whether you wear a flag pin or not on your lapel is a fundamental defining American argument. It's obviously not. Nor is the question of whether you were at a dinner party with a guy who was a weatherman 40 years ago is a fundamental American argument. But I also say in the book, indirectly, that the Democrats have at their peril not taken seriously or viewed as fundamental some arguments that are, including the right of the pro-lifers to at least make the case that a fetus is a person. Okay, so that kind of thing is fine. But yes,
and it's led to charges of elitism among the Democrats, who supposedly are the party of the people.
Yes, and I think that's something you have to deal with. Now, on the question of the media and the debates and so forth, look, we have a showbiz culture, and we have a culture of combat and entertainment. It's not an accident that often, if you look at the New York Times listing of the most popular cable shows on any given Monday morning, I always look at that list, wrestling is often at the top. That's part of who we are, and we have to accept that. And my view of politicians is when they start saying that they are above politics, when they are too good for politics, look out, because that's not the way we do things in this country. It's not.
So you can say that we do not want to have the kind of nasty ads that have upset the public so much, but then if you don't use them, if you don't try to smear your opponent, you're less likely to win.
Well, it's not just smearing. I think you have to expose it. I think I do believe, as Justice Brandeis said, that sunlight is the best disinfectant.
Well, swift boating is what I was thinking of,
right?
For example.
And I think that was a terrible example of nastiness in a campaign that was indefensible. And I fault the Republicans for doing it, and I fault John Kerry for not figuring out how to turn that against, how to turn it against them. You have to use jujitsu in this business if you're going to win. And the best politicians, in my view, are the ones who can hear all the sides of the arguments and who are very contradictory people themselves who figure out how to do that.
We have no time, but looking over some of the other arguments, they all seem to apply to the current situation. Who judges the law? Debt and the dollar, local versus national authority, presidential power, the terms of trade, NAFTA, obviously, war and diplomacy, we all know about that one, the environment, and the last one is a more perfect union. More perfect union? Is that possible?
No. Well, we can get closer and closer, but the fact that we set that as our goal in writing the Constitution both shows our idealism and the difficulty of getting there. I love the phrase that the founders used. It's a total contradiction to say more perfect. Mm-hmm. It's either perfect or it isn't.
Right. It's like more unique.
But they squared that circle by saying, well, you know what? Let's stick more in there, too. Why not?
Howard Fineman is Newsweek's senior Washington correspondent and columnist, and he's also an analyst for NBC and MSNBC. And he's written a book called The 13 American Arguments, Enduring Debates That Define and Inspire Our Country, published by Random House. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Up next, now that spring is here, we'll look into how to feed birds responsibly. Actually, you might be causing a lot of trouble with that bird feeder. Later in the show, the history of bird watching in America. Then Fiona Mazel talks about her debut novel. And we'll speak with one of the country's leading environmentalists on what we can do to save our planet. He doesn't see a great future for us. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. Now, the entire show is available as a podcast.